and was headed straight into the doctoral program there when two things revealed themselves in rapid succession. First, her father had a minor stroke, giving Claire a glimpse of his mortality, and, by extension, her own. And then she had a vision of herself 30 years in the future. A spinster librarian in an apartment full of cats named after New Wave directors. Godard, leave Rivette's chew toy alone! Recalling her breakfast at Tiffany's ambition, Claire quit her doctoral program and ventured out of the cloistered academic world to take one shot at making films rather than simply studying them. She started by applying to one of the biggest talent agencies, the agent who interviewed her barely glancing at her 3-page CV before saying, "Claire, do you know what coverage is?" The agent spoke as if Claire were a 6-year-old, explaining that Hollywood was a very busy place. People attended by agents, managers, accountants, and lawyers. Publicists handled images. Assistants ran errands. Groundskeepers mowed lawns. Maids cleaned houses. Au pairs raised kids. Dog walkers walked dogs. And each day these busy people got stacks of scripts and books and treatments. Didn't it make sense that they'd need help with those too? "Claire," the agent said, "I'm gonna let you in on a secret. No one here reads." Having seen a number of recent movies, Claire didn't think that was a secret. But she kept that answer to herself and became a coverage reader, writing summaries of books, scripts, and treatments, comparing them with hit movies, grading the characters, dialogue, and commercial potential, allowing agents and their clients to seem as if they'd not only read the material but taken a grad-level seminar on it. Title: Second Period, Death. Genre: Young Adult Horror. Logline: The Breakfast Club meets Nightmare on Elm Street in Second Period, Death. The story of a group of students who must battle a deranged substitute teacher who may in fact be a vampire. Then, only 3 months into the job, Claire was reading a middle-brow bestseller, some big gothic chub of sentimentality, and she got to the ridiculous Deus Ex Machina ending. A windstorm dislodges a power pole and an electrical line whips the villain's face. And she just changed it. It was as simple as being in a clothing store, seeing an uneven stack of sweaters, and just straightening them. In her synopsis, she gave the heroine a part in her own rescue and thought nothing more about it. But 2 days later, she got a call. "This is Michael Dean," the voice on the other end of the phone said. "Do you know who I am?" Of course she did, although she was surprised to hear that he was still alive. The man once referred to as the Dean of Hollywood, a man who'd had a hand in some of the biggest films of the late 20th century. All those mobsters, monsters, and meet-cute romances. A former studio executive and capital P producer from an era when that title meant a fit-throwing, career-making, actress-bagging, coke-snorting player. "And you," he said, "are the coverage girl who just fixed the bound pile of shit I paid $100K for." And like that, she had a job. On a studio lot, of all places, with Michael Dean, of all people, as his chief development assistant, personally assigned to help Michael get my ass back in the game. At first, she loved her new job. After the slog of grad school, it was thrilling. The meetings, the buzz. Every day, scripts came in, and treatments, and books, and the pitches. She loved the pitches. "So, there's this guy. And he wakes to find that his wife's a vampire." Writers and producers sweeping into the office. Bottled water for everyone to share their visions. Over credits, we see an alien ship, and we cut to this guy sitting at a computer. And even after she realized these pitches were going nowhere, Claire still enjoyed them. Pitching was a form unto itself, a kind of existential present-tense performance art. It didn't matter how old the story was. They'd pitch a film about Napoleon in the present tense, a caveman movie, even the Bible. "So there's this guy, Jesus, and one day he rises from the dead, like a zombie. Here she was, barely 28, working on a studio lot, not doing what she'd dreamed exactly, but doing what people did in this business. Taking meetings, reading scripts, and hearing pitches. Pretending to like everything while finding myriad reasons to make nothing. And then the worst possible thing happened. Success. She can still hear the pitch. It's called Hookbook. It's like a video Facebook for hookups. Anyone who posts a video on the site is also auditioning for our TV show. We snatch up the best-looking, horniest people, film their dates, and follow the whole thing. Hookups, breakups, weddings. Best of all, it casts itself. We don't pay anyone a cent. Michael set up the show at a secondary cable channel. And just like that, he had his first hit in a decade. A steaming pile of TV/web synchronicity that Claire can't bear to watch. Michael Dean was back. And Claire saw why people worked so hard to not get things made. Because once you did one thing, that became your thing. The only thing you were capable of doing. Now Claire spends her days listening to pitches for Eat It! Obese people racing to eat huge meals. And Rich MILF, Poor MILF. Horny middle-aged women set up on dates with horny young men. It's gotten so bad she started to actually look forward to Wild Pitch Fridays. The one day she still might listen in on a random pitch for a film. Unfortunately, most of these Friday pitches come from Michael's past. People he's met in AA. People he owes favors to, or who owe him favors. People he sees at the club. Old golf partners. Old coke dealers. Women he slept with in the 60s and 70s. Men he slept with in the 80s. Friends of ex-wives and of his three legitimate children, or of his three older, less-than-legitimate ones. His doctor's kid. His gardener's kid. His pool boy's kid. His kid's pool boy. Take, for instance, Claire's 9:30. A liver-spotted TV writer who played squash with Michael during the Reagan years and now wants to make a reality show about his grandkids, proudly displaying their pictures on the conference table. Cute, Claire says, and aw, and how sweet, and yes, they do seem to be overdiagnosing autism now. But Claire can't complain about meetings like this unless she's ready to hear the Michael Dean loyalty lecture. How in this cold town, Michael Dean is a man who never forgets his friends, holding them in tight clench and staring into their eyes. You know I've always loved your work, name here. Come down next Friday and see my girl Claire. Then Michael takes a business card, signs it, and presses it into the person's hand. And just like that, they're in. People with a signed Michael Dean business card might want tickets to a premiere, or the number of a certain actor, or a signed movie poster. But usually what they want is the same thing everyone here wants. To pitch. To pitch here is to live. People pitch their kids into good schools, pitch offers on houses they can't afford, and when they're caught in the arms of the wrong person, pitch unlikely explanations. Hospitals pitch birthing centers. Daycares pitch love. High schools pitch success. Car dealerships pitch luxury. Counselors self-esteem. Masseuses happy endings. Cemeteries eternal rest. It's endless, the pitching. Endless, exhilarating, soul-sucking, and as unrelenting as death. As ordinary as morning sprinklers. A signed Michael Dean business card is a form of currency on this lot. The older, the better, in her estimation. When Claire's 10:15 flashes a card from Michael's days as a studio exec, she hopes for a movie pitch. But the man launches into a reality pitch so awful it might just be brilliant. Paranoid Palace. We take mental patients off their meds, put them in a house with hidden cameras, and fuck with their minds. Turn on a light, and music comes on. Open the refrigerator, and the toilet flushes. And speaking of meds, her 11:30 seems to have gone off his. Michael Dean's neighbor's son striding in wearing a cape and a chinstrap beard, never making eye contact as he pitches a television miniseries about a fantasy world he's created all in his head. If I write it down, someone will steal it. Called The Vereglim Quatrology. Vereglim being an alternate universe in the eighth string dimension. Quatrology being like a trilogy, except with four stories instead of three. As he drones on about the physics of this fantasy world, in Vereglim there's an invisible king, an ongoing centaur rebellion, and male penises are erect for 1 week every year. Claire glances down at the buzzing phone in her lap. If she were still in the market for signs, this would be a good one. Her career-challenged, strip-clubbing lunk of a boyfriend has just gotten up at 20 minutes to noon and texted her this one-word, unpunctuated question. Milk. She pictures Daryl in front of the refrigerator in his underwear, seeing no milk and texting this inane question. Where does he think this extra milk might be? She types back, washing machine. And while the Vereglim guy drones on about his schizoid fantasy, Claire can't help but wonder if fate isn't fucking with her now, mocking the deal she made by giving her the worst Wild Pitch Friday in history. Maybe the worst day of any kind since eighth grade, when an alarmingly gushy period arrived during a co-ed P.E. kickball game and dreamy Marshall Aiken pointed at the blossom on her gym shorts and screamed to the teacher, "Claire's hemorrhaging!" Because it's her brain hemorrhaging now, bleeding out all over the conference table as this wingnut launches into book two of the Vereglim Quatrology. Flandor unsheathes his shadow saber. And another text arrives from Daryl, flashing on the BlackBerry in her lap. Cereal. Jet tires chirp, grab the runway, and Shane Wheeler jerks awake and checks his watch. Still good. Yeah, his plane's an hour late, but he's got 3 hours until his meeting, and he's a mere 14 miles away now. How long can it take to drive 14 miles? At the gate, he uncoils, deplanes, and makes his way in a dream down the long, tiled airport tunnel, through baggage claim and a revolving door, onto a sunlit curb, jumps a bus to the rental car center, falls in line with the smiling Disney bounders, who must have seen the same $24 online rental car coupon, and when his turn in line comes, slides his license and credit card to the rental clerk. She says his name with such significance, Shane Wheeler? That for a deluded moment he imagines he's traveled forward in time and fame, and she's somehow heard of him. But of course, she's just happy to find his reservation. We live in a world of banal miracles. Here for business or pleasure, Mr. Wheeler? Redemption, Shane says. Insurance? Coverage declined, upgrade shaken off, pricey GPS and refueling options rejected. Shane heads off with a rental agreement, a set of keys, and a map that looks like it was drawn by a 10-year-old on meth. Ensconced in a rented red Kia, Shane slides the driver's seat into the same zip code as the steering wheel, takes a breath, starts the car, and rehearses the first words of his first ever pitch. So, there's this guy. An hour later, he's somehow farther from his appointment. Shane's Kia is gridlocked and, he thinks, might even be pointed in the wrong direction, the GPS now seeming like a screaming deal. Shane tosses aside the worthless rental car map and tries Jean Pergo's cell. Voicemail. He tries the agent who set up the meeting, but the agent's assistant says, "Sorry, I don't have Andrew," whatever that means. He begrudgingly tries his mom's cell, then his dad's, and finally, the home number. Shit! Where are they? The next number that pops into his head is his ex-wife's. Sandra is the last person he wants to call right now, but that's just how desperate he feels. His name must pop up on her phone still, because her first words are, "Tell me you're calling because you have the rest of the money you owe me." This is what he hoped to avoid. The whole who ruined whose credit and who stole whose car business that has colored their every conversation for a year. He sighs. As a matter of fact, I'm in the process of getting your money right now, Sandra. You're not giving plasma again. No, I'm in L.A., pitching a movie. She laughs, and then realizes he's serious. Wait, you're writing a movie now? No, I'm pitching a movie. First you pitch it, then you write it. No wonder movies suck, she says. This is classic Sandra, a waitress with a poet's pretensions. They met in Tucson, where she worked at Cup of Heaven, the coffee shop where Shane went to write every morning. He fell for, in order, her legs, her laugh, and the way she idealized writers and was willing to support his work. For her part, she said at the end, she fell mostly for his bullshit. Look, Shane says, could you just hold the cultural criticism and MapQuest Universal City for me? You seriously have a meeting in Hollywood? Yes, Shane says, with a big producer on a studio lot. What are you wearing? He sighs and tells her what Jean Pergo told him, that it doesn't matter what one wears to a pitch meeting unless you own a bullshit-proof suit. I'll bet I know what you're wearing, Sandra says, and proceeds to describe his outfit down to the socks. Shane is regretting this call. Just help me figure out where I'm going. What's your movie called? Shane sighs. He has to remember they're no longer married. Her bitter, cool, ironic streak has no power over him anymore. Donner! Sandra is quiet a moment. But she knows his interests, his reading table obsessions. You're writing a movie about cannibals? I told you I'm pitching a movie, and it's not about cannibals. Clearly, the Donner Party could be a tough subject for a film. But pitches are all in the take, as Michael Dean wrote in the oft-copied chapter 14 of his memoir-slash-self-help classic, The Dean's Way. Ideas are sphincters. Every asshole has one. Your take is what counts. I could walk into Fox today and sell a movie about a restaurant that serves baked monkey balls if I had the right take. And Shane has the perfect take. Donner will concern itself not with the classic Donner Party story, all those people stuck at the awful camp, freezing and starving to death and finally eating one another, but with the story of a cabinet maker in the party named William Eddy, who leads a group of people, mostly young women, on a harrowing, heroic journey out of the mountains to safety, and then, attention, third act, when he's regained his strength, returns to rescue his wife and kids. As Shane pitched this idea over the phone to the agent Andrew Dunn, he felt himself becoming animated by its power. It's a story of triumph, he told the agent. An epic story of resiliency, courage, determination, love. That very afternoon, the agent set up a meeting with Claire Silver, a development assistant for, get this, Michael Dean. Huh, Sandra says when she's heard the whole story. And you really think you can sell this thing? Yes, I do, Shane says. And he does. It's a key subtenet of Shane's movie-inspired act-as-if faith in himself. His generation's profound belief in secular episodic providence, the idea honed by decades of entertainment, that after 30 or 60 or 120 minutes of complications, things generally work out. Okay, Sandra says, still not entirely immune to the undeniable charm of Shane's deluded self-belief. And she gives him the MapQuest instructions. When he thanks her, Sandra says, good luck today, Shane. Thanks, Shane says. And, as always, his ex-wife's passionless, entirely genuine goodwill leaves him feeling like the loneliest person on the planet. It's over. What a stupid deal. One day to find a great idea for a film? How many times has Michael told her, we're not in the film business, we're in the buzz business? And yes, the day's not quite over. But her 245 is picking at an open scab on his forehead while pitching a TV procedural.
So there's this cop.
Pick.
A zombie cop.
And Claire feels the loss of something vital in her. The death of some optimism. Her 4 p.m. looks like a no-show. Somebody named Sean Weller. And when Claire checks her watch, 4:10, it is through bleary, sleepy eyes. So that's it. She's done. She won't say anything to Michael about her disillusionment. What would be the point? She'll quietly give 2 weeks, box up her things, and slink out of this office into a job warehousing souvenirs for the Scientologists. And what about Daryl? Does she dump him today, too? Can she? She's tried breaking up with him recently, but it never takes. It's like cutting soup. Nothing to push against. She'll say, "Daryl, we need to talk." And he just smiles in that way of his, and they end up having sex. She even suspects it turns him on a little. She'll say, "I'm not sure this is working." And he'll start taking off his shirt. She'll complain about the strip clubs, and he'll just look amused. Her, "Promise me you won't go again." Him, "I promise I won't make you go." He doesn't fight, doesn't lie, doesn't care. The man eats, breathes, screws. How do you disengage from someone who's already so profoundly disengaged? She met him on what is now looking like the only movie she'll ever work on, Night Ravagers. Claire has always been weak for ink, and Daryl, who had a walk-on, lurch-on? Stagger-on? As zombie number 14, had these great, ropey, tattooed arms. She dated mostly smart-sensitive types, who made her smart sensitivity seem redundant, and a couple of slick industry types, whose ambition was like a second dick. She hadn't yet tried the unemployed actor type. And wasn't this what she had in mind when she left the cocoon of film school in the first place? Tasting the visceral, the worldly? And at first, visceral worldly was as good as advertised. She recalls wondering, "Was I ever even touched before this?" 36 hours later, as she lay post-coital in bed with the best-looking guy she'd ever slept with, sometimes she just likes to look at him, Daryl matter-of-factly admitted that he'd just been tossed out by his girlfriend and had no place to live. Almost 3 years later, Night Ravagers remains Daryl's best acting credit, and zombie number 14 remains a gorgeous lump in her bed. No, she won't break up with Daryl. Not today. Not after the Scientologists and the proud grandpas, the lunatics, zombie cops, and skin pickers. She'll give Daryl one more chance. Go home, bring him a beer, nestle into his broad, tatted shoulder. Together, they'll watch the TV. He likes those trucks that drive across the ice on the Discovery Channel. And she'll have that tenuous connection to life, at least. No, it's not the stuff of dreams. But it's a perfectly American thing to do. A whole nation of Night Ravager zombies racing across the horizon, burning through peak oil to get home and sit dull-eyed, watching Ice Road Truckers and Hookbook on the 55-inch flat, the double nickel, as Daryl calls it, the Sammy Hagar. Claire grabs her coat and starts for the door. She pauses, glances back over her shoulder at the office where she thought she might get to make something great. Silly Holly-go-lightly dream. And once more checks her watch. 4:17 and counting. Outside, she locks the door behind her, takes a breath, and goes. The clock in Shane's rented Kia also reads 4:17. He's more than a quarter hour late, and he's dying. Shit, shit, shit! He pounds the steering wheel. Even after finally getting turned around, he got caught in several traffic snarls and took the wrong exit. By the time he rolls up to the studio gate and the security guard shrugs and informs him that his destiny is at the other gate, He is 24 minutes late, sweating through his carefully chosen whatever clothing. When he arrives at the proper gate, he's 28 minutes late. 30 when he finally gets his ID back from the second security guard, shakily slaps a parking pass on his dash and pulls into the lot. Shane is only 200 feet away now from Michael Dean's bungalow, but he stumbles out of his car the wrong way, wanders among the big sound stages. It is the cleanest warehouse district in the world. And finally walks in a circle toward a nest of bungalows and a tram filled with fanny-packed tourists on a studio tour, holding up cameras and cell phones, listening to a microphone-aided guide tell apocryphal stories of bygone magic. The camera people listen breathlessly, waiting for some connection to their own pasts. I loved that show! And when Shane staggers up to their tram, the star-alert tourists run his disheveled hair, broad sideburns and thin, frantic features through the thousands of celebrity faces they keep on file. Is that a Sheen? A Baldwin? A celebrity rehabber? And while they can't quite match Shane's oddly appealing features with anyone famous, they take pictures anyway, just in case. The tour guide chutters into his headset, telling the tram people in something like English how a certain famous breakup scene from a certain famous television show was famously filmed right over there. And as Shane approaches, the driver holds up a finger so he can finish his story. Sweating, near tears, in full overheated self-loathing, fighting every urge to call his parents, his act resolve now a distant memory, Shane finds himself staring at the tour guide's name tag. Angel. Excuse me? Shane says. Angel covers the headset microphone and says, heavily accented, Fuck you want? Angel is roughly his age, so Shane tries for late 20s camaraderie. Dude, I'm totally late. Can you help me find Michael Dean's office? Something about this question causes another tourist to take Shane's picture. But Angel merely jerks his thumb and drives the tram away, revealing a sign that he was blocking, pointing to a bungalow, Michael Dean Productions. Shane looks at his watch. 36 minutes late now. Shit, shit, shit. He runs around the corner and there it is. But blocking the door to the bungalow is an old man with a cane. For a second, Shane thinks it might be Michael Dean himself, even though the agent said Dean wouldn't be at the meeting, that it would just be his development assistant, Claire something. Anyway, it's not Michael Dean. It's just some old guy, 70, maybe, in a dark gray suit and charcoal fedora, cane draped over his arm, holding a business card. As Shane's feet clack on the pavement, the old man turns and removes his fedora, revealing a shock of slate hair and eyes that are a strange coral blue. Shane clears his throat. Are you going in? 'Cause I'm very late. The man holds out a business card. Ancient, wrinkled and stained, the type faded. It's from another studio, 20th Century Fox, but the name is right, Michael Dean. You're in the right place, Shane says. He presents his own Michael Dean business card, the newer model. See? He's at this studio now. Yes, I go this one, says the man, heavily accented, Italian. Shane recognizes it from the year he studied in Florence. He points at the 20th Century card. They say, go this one. He points to the bungalow. But it's locked. Shane can't believe it. He steps past the man and tries the door. Yes, locked. Then it's over. Pasquale Tursi, says the man, holding out his hand. Shane shakes it. Big loser, he says. Claire has texted Daryl to ask what he wants for dinner. His answer, KFC, is followed by another text, Unrated Hookbook. She's told Daryl that her company is about to stream out an unrated, raunchier version of that show, full of all the nudity and sodden stupidity they couldn't air on regular TV. Fine, she thinks. She'll go back for her company's apocalyptic TV show, then swing through the KFC drive-thru, and she'll curl up with Daryl and deal with her life on Monday. She turns her car around, is waved back through security, and parks back in the lot above Michael's bungalow office. She starts back to the office to get the raw DVDs, but when she rounds the path, Claire Silver sees, standing at the door to the bungalow, not one Wild Pitch Friday lost cause, but two. She stops, imagines turning around and leaving. Sometimes she makes a guess about Wild Friday pictures, and she does this now. Mop-haired sideburns in factory-torn blue jeans and faux western shirt. Michael's old coke dealer's son. And old silver-haired, blue-eyed charcoal suit. This one's tougher. Some guy Michael met in 1965 while getting rimmed at an orgy at Tony Curtis's house? The frantic younger guy sees her approaching. Are you Claire Silver?
No, she thinks.
Yes, she says. I'm Shane Wheeler, and I'm so sorry. There was traffic and I got lost, and is there any chance we could still have our meeting?
She looks helplessly at the older guy who removes his hat and extends the business card.
Pasquale Tursi, he says. I am look for Mr. Dean.
Great. Two lost causes. A kid who can't find his way around L.A. and a time-traveling Italian. Both men stare at her, hold out Michael Dean business cards. She takes the cards. The young guy's card is, predictably, newer. She turns it over. Below Michael's signature is a note from the agent Andrew Dunn. She recently screwed Andrew. Not in that she had sex with him. That would be forgivable. But she asked him to hold off circulating a sizzle reel for his client's unscripted fashion show, If the Shoe Fits, while Michael considered it. Instead, he optioned a competing show, Shoe Fetish, which effectively killed Andrew's client's idea. The agent's note reads, Hope you enjoy. A payback pitch. Oh, this must be horrible. The other card is a mystery. The oldest Michael Dean business card she's ever seen. Faded and wrinkled from Michael's first studio, 20th Century Fox. It's the job that catches her. Publicity? Michael started in publicity? How old is this card? Honestly, after the days she's had, if Daryl had texted anything other than KFC and unrated hookbook, she might have just told these two guys the game was up. They'd miss today's charity wagon. But she thinks again about fate and the deal she made. Who knows? Maybe one of these guys... Right. She unlocks the door and asks their names again. Sloppy sideburns equals Shane. Popping eyes equals Pasquale. Why don't you both come on back to the conference room? She says. In the office, they sit beneath posters from Michael's classic movies. Mind Blow. The Love Burglar. No time for pleasantries. It's the first pitch meeting in history in which no water is proffered. Mr. Tursi, would you like to go first? He looks around, confused. Mr. Dean? He's not here? His accent is heavy, as if he's chewing on each word. I'm afraid he's not here today. Are you an old friend of his?
I meet him.
He stares at the ceiling.
Nel 62.
1962, says the young guy. When Claire looks curiously at him, Shane shrugs. I spent a year studying in Italy. Claire imagines Michael and this old guy back in the day tooling around Rome in a convertible, screwing Italian actresses, drinking grappa. Now Pasquale Tursi looks disoriented.
He say, you ever need anything?
Sure, Claire says. I promise I'll tell Michael all about your pitch. Why don't you just start at the beginning? Pasquale squints as if he doesn't understand.
My English is long time.
The beginning, Shane tells Pasquale.
L'inizio. There's this guy, Claire urges.
A woman,
Pasquale Tursi says.
She come to my village, Porto Vergogna, in...
He looks over at Shane for help. 1962? Shane says again.
Yes, she is beautiful, and I am build a beach, yes, and tennis.
He rubs his brow, the story already getting away from him.
She is in the cinema.
An actress? Shane Wheeler asks.
Yes.
Pasquale Tursi nods and stares off into space. Claire checks her watch and does her best to jumpstart his pitch. So, an actress comes to this town and she falls for this guy who's building a beach? Pasquale looks back at Claire.
No, for me, maybe, yes. E l'attimo, yes?
He looks at Shane for help.
L'attimo che dura per sempre.
The moment that lasts forever, Shane says quietly.
Yes,
Pasquale says and nods.
Forever.
Claire feels pinched by those words in such close proximity. Moment and forever. Not exactly KFC and hookbook. She suddenly feels angry at her silly ambition and romanticism, at her taste in men, at the loopy Scientologists, at her father for watching that stupid movie and then leaving, at herself for coming back to the office, at herself because she keeps hoping for better. And Michael. Goddamn Michael and his goddamn job and his goddamn business cards and his goddamn old buzzard friends and the goddamn favors he owes the goddamn people he screwed back when he screwed everything that's screwed. Pasquale Tursi sighs.
She was sick.
Claire flushes with impatience. With what? Lupus? Psoriasis? Cancer? At the word cancer, Pasquale looks up suddenly and mutters in Italian,
Sì, ma non è così semplice.
And that's when the kid Shane interrupts. Miss Silver? I don't think this guy's pitching. And he says to the man in slow Italian,
Questo è realmente accaduto? Non in un film?
Pasquale nods.
Sì, sono qui per trovarla.
Yeah, this really happened, Shane tells Claire. He turns back to Pasquale.
Non l'ha più vista da allora?
Pasquale shakes his head no, and Shane turns back to Claire again. He hasn't seen this actress in almost 50 years. He came to find her.
Come si chiama?
Shane Wheeler asks. The Italian looks from Claire to Shane and back again.
Di More, he says.
And Claire feels a tug in her chest, some deeper shift, a cracking of her hard-earned cynicism, of this anxious tension she's been fighting. The actress's name means nothing to her, but the old guy seems utterly changed by saying it aloud, as if he hadn't said the name in years. Something about the name affects her, too, a crush of romantic recognition, those words, moment and forever, as if she can feel 50 years of longing in that one name, 50 years of an ache that lies dormant in her, too, maybe lies dormant in everyone until it's cracked open like this. And so weighted is this moment, she has to look to the ground or else feel the tears burn her own eyes. And at that moment Claire glances at Shane and sees that he must feel it too, the name hanging in the air for just a moment, among the three of them, and then floating to the floor like a falling leaf, the Italian watching it settle, Claire guessing, hoping, praying the old Italian will say the name once again, more quietly this time, to underline its importance, the way it's so often done in scripts. But he doesn't do this. He just stares at the floor where the name has fallen. And it occurs to Claire Silver that she's seen too goddamn many movies. Chapter 3. The Hotel Adequate View. April 1962. Porto Vergogna, Italy. All day he waited for her to come downstairs, but she spent that first afternoon and evening alone in her room on the third floor. And so Pasquale went about his business, which seemed not like business at all, but the random behavior of a lunatic. Still, he didn't know what else to do. So he threw rocks at the breakwater in the cove, and he chipped away at his tennis court, and he glanced up occasionally at the whitewashed shutters over the windows in her room. In the late afternoon, when the feral cats were sunning themselves on the rocks, a cool spring wind chopped the surface of the sea, and Pasquale retreated to the piazza to smoke alone, before the fishermen came to drink. At the adequate view, there was no noise from upstairs, no sign at all that the beautiful American was even up there. And Pasquale worried again that he had imagined the whole thing. Orencio's boat lurching into the cove, the tall, slender American walking up the narrow staircase to the best room in the hotel, on the third floor, pushing open the window shutters, breathing in the salty air, pronouncing it lovely. Pasquale saying she should let him know if there was anything upon your happy to having, and her saying, thank you, and pushing the door closed, leaving him to descend the tight, dark staircase alone. Pasquale was horrified to find that for dinner, his Aunt Valeria was making her signature choupin, a soup of rockfish, tomatoes, white wine, and olive oil.
You expect me to take your rotting fish head stew to an American cinema star? She can leave if she doesn't like it, Valeria said.
So at dusk, with the fishermen pulling their boats up into the cove below, Pasquale clicked up the narrow staircase built into the rock wall. He knocked lightly on the third floor door. Yes? The American called through the door. He heard the bed springs creak. Pasquale cleared his throat.
I am sorry for you disturb. You eat antipasti and the soap, yes?
Soap? Pasquale felt angry that he hadn't talked his aunt out of making the choupin.
Yes, is a soap, with fish and vino, a fish soap.
Oh, soup. No, thank you. I don't think I can eat anything just yet, she said, her voice muffled through the door. I don't feel well enough.
Yes, he said. I see.
He descended the stairs, saying the word soup over and over in his mind. He ate the American's dinner in his own room on the second floor. The choupin was pretty good. He still got his father's newspapers by mailboat once a week, and although he didn't study them the way his father had, Pasquale flipped through them, looking for news about the American production of Cleopatra. But he found nothing. Later he heard clumping around in the trattoria and came out, but he knew it wouldn't be Di More. She did not appear to be a clumper. Instead, both tables were full of local fishermen hoping to get a look at the glorious American, their hats on the tables, dirty hair plastered and combed tight to their skulls. Valeria was serving them soup, but the fishermen were really just waiting to talk to Pasquale, since they'd been out in their boats when the American arrived.
I hear she is 2.5 meters tall, said Lugo, the promiscuous war hero,
famous for the dubious claim that he had killed at least one soldier from every major participant in the European theater of World War II.
She's a giant.
Don't be stupid, Pasquale said as he filled their glasses with wine.
What is the shape of her breasts?
Asked Lugo seriously.
Are they round giants or alert peaks? Let me tell you about American women, said Tommaso the Elder,
whose cousin had married an American, making him an expert on American women, along with everything else.
American women cook only one meal a week, but before they marry, they perform fellatio. So, as with all life, there is good and there is bad. You should eat from a trough like pigs,
Valeria spat from the kitchen.
Marry me, Valeria, Tommaso the Elder called back. I am too old for sex, and my hearing will soon be gone. We are made for each other.
The fisherman that Pasquale liked best, thoughtful Tommaso the Communist, was chewing on his pipe. He removed it now to weigh in on the subject.
He considered himself something of a film buff, and was a fan of Italian neorealism, and therefore dismissive of American movies, which he blamed for sparking the dreadful Commedia all'Italiana movement, the antic farces that had replaced the serious existential cinema of the late 1950s.
"Listen, Lugo," he said, "if she is an American actress, it means she wears a corset in cowboy films, and has talent only for screaming. Fine, let's see those big breasts fill with air when she screams," Lugo said. "Maybe she will lie naked on Pasquale's beach tomorrow," said Tommaso the Elder, "and we can see for ourselves her giant breasts."
For 300 years, the fishermen in town had come from a small pool of young men who'd grown up here, fathers handing over their skiffs and eventually their houses to favored sons, usually the eldest, who married the daughters of other fishermen up and down the coast, sometimes bringing them back to Porto Vergogna. Children moved away, but the villaggio always maintained a kind of equilibrium, and the 20 or so houses stayed full. But after the war, when fishing, like everything else, had become an industry, the family fishermen couldn't compete with the big seiners motoring out of Genoa every week. The restaurants would still buy from a few old fishermen, because tourists liked to see the old men bring in their catches. But this was like working in an amusement park. It wasn't real fishing, and there was no future in it. An entire generation of Porto Vergogna boys had to leave to find work, to La Spezia and Genoa, and even farther for jobs in factories and canneries and in the trades. No longer did the favored son want the fishing boat. Already 6 of the houses were empty, boarded or brought down. More were sure to follow. In February, Tommaso the Communist's last daughter, the unfortunately cross-eyed Elena, had married a young teacher and moved away to La Spezia, Tommaso sulking for days afterward. And on one of those cool spring mornings, as Pasquale watched the old fishermen scuff and grumble to their boats, it dawned on him. He was the only person under 40 left in the whole town. Pasquale left the fisherman in the trattoria to go see his mother, who was in one of her dark periods and had refused to leave her bed for 2 weeks. When he opened the door, he could see her staring at the ceiling, her wiry gray hair stuck to the pillow behind her, arms crossed over her chest, mouth in the placid death face that she liked to rehearse.
"You should get up, Mamma. Come out and eat with us." "Not today, Pasco," she rasped. "Today I hope to die."
She took a deep breath and opened one eye.
"Valeria tells me there is an American in the hotel."
"Yes, Mamma." He checked her bed sores, but his aunt had already powdered them.
"A woman?"
"Yes, Mamma."
"Then your father's Americans have finally arrived."
She glanced over at the dark window.
"He said they would come, and here they are. You should marry this woman and go to America to make a proper tennis field."
"No, Mamma, you know I wouldn't
leave before this place kills you, like it killed your father."
"I would never leave you.
Don't worry about me. I will die soon enough and go to be with your father and with your poor brothers."
"You're not dying," Pasquale said.
"I am already dead inside," she said. "You should push me out into the sea and drown me like that old sick cat of yours."
Pasquale straightened.
"You said my cat ran away while I was at university."
She shot him a glance from the corner of her eye.
"It is a saying."
"No, it's not a saying. There is no saying such as that. Did you and Papa drown my cat while I was in Florence?"
"I'm sick, Pasqua. Why do you torment me?"
Pasquale went back to his room. That night he heard footsteps on the third floor as the American went to the bathroom. But the next morning she still hadn't emerged from her room, so he went about his work on the beach. When he returned to the hotel for lunch, his Aunt Valeria said the Di More had come down for an espresso
a piece of torta and an orange.
What did she say? Pasquale asked.
How would I know? That awful language, like someone choking on a bone.
Pasquale crept up the stairs and listened at her door, but Di More was quiet. He went back outside and down to his beach, but it was hard to tell if the currents had taken any more sand away. He climbed up past the hotel onto the boulders where he'd staked out his tennis court. The sun was high over the coast and hidden by wispy clouds, which flattened the sky and made him feel as if he were under glass. He looked down at the stakes that marked his future tennis court and felt ashamed. Even if he could build forms high enough to contain the concrete to level his court, 6 feet high at the edges of the boulders, and manage to cantilever some of the court so that it hung out over the cliff, he would still have to blast away at the cliffside with dynamite to flatten the northeast corner. He wondered if it was possible to have a smaller tennis court, maybe with smaller rackets. He had just lit a cigarette to think about it when he saw Orencio's mahogany boat round the point up the coast near Vernazza. He watched it angle away from the chop along the shoreline, and he held his breath as it passed Rio Maggiore. As it got closer, he could see there were 2 people besides Orencio in the boat. Were these more Americans coming to his hotel? It was almost too much to hope for. Of course, the boat was likely going past him, to lovely Porto Venere, or around the point into La Spezia. But then the boat slowed and curled into his narrow cove. Pasquale began climbing down from his tennis court, hopping from boulder to boulder. Finally, he walked along the narrow trail down to the shoreline, slowing up when he saw that it wasn't tourists in the boat with Orencio, but 2 men. Gualfredo, the bastard hotelier, and a huge man Pasquale had never seen before. Orencio tied the boat up, and Gualfredo and the big man climbed out. Gualfredo was all jowls, bald, with a huge brush mustache. The other man, the giant, appeared to be carved from granite. In the boat, Orencio looked down, as if he couldn't bear to meet Pasquale's eyes. As Pasquale approached, Gualfredo put his hands out.
So it's true. Carlo Tursi's son returns a man to tend the horse crack.
Pasquale nodded grimly and formally. Good day, Signor Gualfredo. He'd never seen the bastard Gualfredo in Porto Vergogna before, but the man's story was well known on the coast. His mother had carried on a long affair with a wealthy Milan banker, and to buy her silence, the man had given her petty criminal son interests in hotels in Porto Venere, Chiavari, and Monte Rosso al Mare. Gualfredo smiled.
You have an American actress in your old whorehouse?
Yes, Pasquale said. We sometimes have American guests.
Gualfredo frowned, his mustache seeming to weigh down his face and his trunk of a neck. He looked over at Orencio, who pretended to be checking the boat motor.
I told Orencio there must be a mistake. This woman was surely meant to be at my hotel in Porto Venere. But he claims that she really wanted to come to this...
He looked around.
Village.
Yes, Pasquale said. She prefers the quiet.
Gualfredo stepped in closer.
This is not some Swiss farmer on holiday, Pasquale. These Americans expect a level of service you can't provide, especially the American cinema people. Listen to me. I've been doing this a long time. It would be regrettable if you were to give the Levante a bad reputation.
We are taking care of her, Pasquale said.
Then you won't mind if I talk to her, to make sure there wasn't some mistake?
You can't, Pasquale said too quickly. She's sleeping now.
Gualfredo looked back at Orencio in the boat, and then returned his dead eyes to Pasquale.
Or perhaps you are keeping me from her because she has been tricked by 2 old friends who took advantage of a woman's poor Italian to convince her to come to Porto Vergogna rather than Porto Venere
as she intended.
Orenzio opened his mouth to object, but Pasquale beat him to it.
Of course not. Look, you're welcome to come back later when she is not resting and ask her anything you like, but I won't let you disturb her now. She's sick.
A smile pushed at the ends of Gualfredo's mustache, and he gestured at the giant beside him.
Do you know Signor Pelle, of the Tourism Guild?
No. Pasquale tried to meet the big man's eyes, but they were tiny pinpoints in the fleshy face. His silver suit coat strained beneath his bulk.
For a small yearly fee and a reasonable tax, the Tourism Guild provides benefits for all the legitimate hotels. Transportation, advertising, political representation.
Sicurezza,
added Signor Pelle in a bullfrog voice.
Ah, yes, thank you, Signor Pelle. Security, said Gualfredo,
half of his shrub mustache rising in a smirk.
Protection.
Pasquale knew better than to ask, protection from what? Clearly, Signor Pelle provided protection from Signor Pelle.
My father never said anything about this tax, Pasquale said,
and he got a quick glance of warning from Orenzio. It was something Pasquale was trying to figure out, endemic to doing business in Italy, determining which of the countless shakedowns and corruptions were necessary to pay and which could safely be ignored. Gualfredo smiled.
Oh, your father paid. A yearly fee, and also a small per-night foreign guest fee, which we haven't always collected, because, frankly, we didn't think there were any foreign guests in the horse crack.
He shrugged.
10%. It's nothing. Most hotels pass the tax on to their guests.
Pasquale cleared his throat.
And if I don't pay?
This time, Gualfredo did not smile. Orenzio glanced up at Pasquale, another grim look of warning on his face. Pasquale crossed his arms to keep them from shaking.
If you can provide some documentation of this tax, then I will pay it.
Gualfredo was quiet for a long moment. Finally, he laughed and looked around. He said to Pelle,
Signor Tursi would like documentation.
Pelle stepped forward slowly.
Okay, Pasquale said, angry with himself for caving so quickly. I don't need documentation.
But he wished he'd made the brute Pelle take more than one step. He glanced over his shoulder to make sure the American woman's shutters were closed and that she hadn't witnessed his cowardice.
I'll be back in a moment.
He started back up the crease toward his hotel, face burning. He could never remember feeling more ashamed. His Aunt Valeria was in the kitchen watching.
Zia, Pasquale said, did my father pay this tax to Gualfredo?
Valeria, who had never liked Pasquale's father, scoffed.
Of course.
Pasquale counted the money out in his room and started back for the marina, trying to control his anger. Pelle and Gualfredo were facing the sea when he returned, Orenzio sitting in the boat with his arms crossed. Pasquale's hand shook as he handed over the money. Gualfredo slapped Pasquale's face lightly, as if he were a cute child.
We'll come back later to talk to her. We can figure out the fees and back taxes then.
Pasquale's face reddened again, but he held his tongue. Gualfredo and Pelle climbed in the mahogany boat, and Orenzio pushed them off without looking at Pasquale. The boat bobbed in the chop for a moment, then the coughing engine found its voice, and the men rumbled back up the coast. Pasquale sulked on the porch of his hotel. There was a full moon that night, and the fishermen were out in their boats, using the extra moonlight to hit the thrashing squall of a spring run. Pasquale leaned out over the wooden railing he'd built, smoking and replaying the ugly business with Gualfredo and the giant Pelle, imagining brave rejoinders.
Take your tax and use your snake's tongue to push it up your big friend's greasy ass, Gualfredo!
when he heard the springs on the door open and close. He glanced over his shoulder, and there she was, the beautiful American. She wore tight